Helen is going to be presenting the fifth presentation in the series of God Is Not One. And I'll just do a brief introduction. Many of you, most of you, all of you will know Helen. So, Helen is a retired university professor who has been a member of the fellowship for nearly 3 years. She is originally from Montreal, but has lived in Holland, England, and France. She came here from Calgary when she was invited to apply for a job in the Faculty of Education at the University of Regina. She is married to Bruno Tahoot, our lay chaplain, whom she met on vacation in Africa in 1976. Helen is the chair of the Sunday Service Committee, and welcome, Helen.
Can you hear? Oh, wow. Hello. Okay. Well, this is very challenging because there's so much on Buddhism in God Is Not One that I had to be very, very selective, unless you wanted to stay here all day. But it was very funny because we were looking for someone to present today, and then I said in the Sunday Service Committee, well, you know, we could do the fifth one on Buddhism. Hey, look at it. Timing is everything. This was from one of the papers from this week from the Metro. Look at, is timing good or what? It says, "Happy birthday, Buddha." So this is the time of the year when the Koreans celebrate the birth of Buddha, and there's a picture of a parade. And they said, although the exact date is unknown, scholars believe the Buddha was born some 2,557 years ago. In Korea, his birthday is traditionally celebrated on the full moon in May. So, we got it. Now, before I start with the different things in the presentation, I'm going to ask you, and I'm going to ask you this another time, I'm not asking you to meditate, do whatever you like, but I want to take just a few seconds, and I want each person, you can say it to yourself, you can close your eyes, you can do whatever you like, or you can not say it, okay? That's the practice of Buddhism, whatever you like. And if you would like to, just say to yourself, I am basically good. So, depending on the number of people who have said it, this room is full of basically good people. Pretty well, eh? And that's... But I believe you are basically good, you see, so. So that was one of the things that attracted me to Buddhism. I had been brought up, and I think I've said this before, I've been brought up as a Lutheran, I've been a Sunday school teacher, I've read many parts of the Bible, and I turned away from Christianity because of the whole idea that I took. Now, this is a personal thing, so I'm not going to, it's not a theoretical argument, but I felt the idea that I needed a savior, that I was basically sinful, and that I needed a savior was not very attractive to me. And I don't know how, maybe I went to a talk or I went to a something, and that whole idea that I heard of it, that I, and I'm saying I, because I can't speak for you, I am basically good, and one of my tasks, maybe a primary task in life, is to get in touch with the goodness within myself. And I thought, now that is a very neat idea. And I started, well, I guess it's the intellectual side of me, the interest in intellectual thing. I started reading, and I have brought some of my books here. I'm going to say something about each of them because they are famous Buddhist teachers. Anyway, but right now, let's get into this. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to... tell you a little bit about Buddha, and who knows how much of it is true, because it was a long time ago, so this is a legend. And for Prothero, Buddhism begins with a fairy tale. Well, it's like a fairy tale. In the 6th century before the Common Era. So that's kind of, so that fits with our newspaper. In the 6th century before the Common Era, in other words, about 2,600 years ago, or maybe even a century earlier, nobody knows for sure, in the foothills of the Himalaya Mountains, a young prince, Siddhartha Gautama, grew up motherless. She had died giving birth to him. When Siddhartha turned 16, it is believed his father arranged for him to marry his cousin of the same age. The couple would go on to have a son. As Siddhartha was growing up, his father made sure, so he was born into a rich family, his father wanted to make sure that his son was sheltered from the real world. He didn't want him to see any of the ugliness out there. And he had the power to do that, eh? But in his 20s, Siddhartha told his father that he wanted to see that real world. According to legend, his father then carefully orchestrated what turned out to be 4 tours of the real world. Siddhartha was taken around on these tours by a charioteer. And despite all his father's efforts to continue to shield his son from reality, on each of these tours, Siddhartha saw something he'd never seen before. A sick person, an old person, a corpse, and on the 4th tour, a wandering holy man. And remember again, this is the legend. Who knows, you know? Anyway, legend has it that when he asked the charioteer for an explanation, the latter replied, so for instance, what's that, a sick person? The latter replied, a sick person. Each of us falls ill. You and I are alike. No one is exempt from sickness. And the charioteer answered in a similar fashion to the idea of an old person. No one is exempt from being old. The corpse, no one is exempt from dying. With regard to the wandering holy man, the charioteer said that he was a wandering ascetic, a loner, who had left behind spouse, family, job, and home in search of spiritual liberation. And so, looking at his life through the prism of suffering, sickness, old age, and death, Siddhartha decided to leave home and begin the life of a wandering holy man. It is believed that for years Siddhartha wandered around northern India, studying with various yogis, teachers, and searching for a solution to the problem of human suffering. Furthermore, as Siddhartha gradually whittled his body down to skin and bones, his renown as an ascetic grew. But his ability to focus on his spiritual goal diminished. I guess, you know, you have to feed the brain. And so he left his teachers and fellow students behind to strike out on his own, on a middle path, eating and sleeping just enough to be able to survive. At the age of 35, 6 years after he had left home, legend has it that Siddhartha sat cross-legged under a tree in Bodh Gaya in northern India, vowing not to get up until he had learned the secret of our everlasting wandering from rebirth to rebirth. After 49 days, he was awakened, meaning that he saw that all things are impermanent and ever-changing. He saw how we suffer because we wish the world were otherwise. And through these insights, his own suffering went away. From that point onward, he was known as the Buddha, which means the awakened one. So it's the Buddha, which is a title rather than a name, the Buddha. After this experience, the Buddha returned to his itinerant life, wandering in silence for days. But then, after encountering five fellow travelers in a deer park in northern India, he delivered what Prothero calls his first sermon. At the heart of this sermon were the Four Noble Truths. And one of these books is just only about that. So, the first noble truth: all human existence is characterized by suffering, or dukkha. Literally meaning, and I give you the translation, literally meaning that which is difficult to bear. Dukkha can go from extreme physical and mental pain and torment to subtle inner conflicts and a general feeling of bodily discomfort and weakness, or malaise. So that's the first noble truth. All human existence is characterized by suffering. The second noble truth: suffering has an origin. Everything in this world is interdependent, linked in a great chain of cause and effect. And that idea of interdependence is a key idea in Buddhism. For Buddhists, the key cause and effect links are ignorance, thirst, and grasping. We suffer because we close our eyes to the way the world really is. We pretend we are independent when we are really interdependent. We pretend that changing things are unchanging. And we desperately desire the world and the people who populate it to be as we imagine it and them to be. I think this fits in quite well with our Unitarian thinking, doesn't it? So, suffering has an origin. The third noble truth: since suffering has a cause, it can be eliminated. If we wake up to the way the world really is, we can achieve nirvana, or enlightenment. The fourth noble truth: there is a path to reach the goal of nirvana. This path is known as the Eightfold Path. These are the key beliefs of Buddhism, and one of those books here. Because the Eightfold Path has ethical, experiential, and doctrinal dimensions, it is traditionally divided into three parts: ethical, right speech, so ethical conduct, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And I checked that. And right livelihood meaning of that is livelihood based on correct action, the ethical principle of non-exploitation. So that's the first part, ethical conduct. Mental discipline: right effort, right mindfulness. And here, the mindfulness, the meaning of that is awareness of things, of oneself, feelings, thought, people, and reality. Mindfulness. So, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Wisdom: right understanding, and right thought. So, the three parts: ethical conduct, mental discipline, and wisdom. And Prothero sums it up, he says, in short, be kind, be mindful, and be wise. So the Four Noble Truths, in which the fourth one contains the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path has been called a process to help you remove or move beyond the conditioned responses that obscure your true nature. The Buddha called his teachings a raft, and this is another story about Buddha. To cross a turbulent river, we may need to build a raft. When the raft is built, we single-mindedly and with great energy make our way across the river. Once across, we don't need to cart the raft around with us. In other words, don't cling to anything, including the teachings. However, make sure you use the teachings before you let them go. It's no use knowing everything about the raft and then not getting on. The teachings are tools, not doctrine. And that's a very interesting point. And that I didn't get from Prothero. I got that from the internet, and that's from the Buddha Dharma Education Association. So let us return to Buddha himself. One of the most famous stories about the Buddha's teachings is about a man who keeps asking him metaphysical questions. Is the world eternal? Are body and soul one and the same? The Buddha responds to these questions with questions of his own. If you were shot with a poisoned arrow, would you waste your time and breath asking who shot the arrow, how tall he was, and of what complexion? Wouldn't you just pull the arrow out? Buddhism is about removing the arrow of suffering. Speculation only plugs more pain and poison into the skin. At the age of 80, the Buddha ate a bad piece of meat that had been placed in his begging bowl. He died of food poisoning. His followers cremated his body and distributed the remains as relics. It is said that Buddha's last words were, "Be lamps unto yourselves. Work out your own liberation with diligence." Upon the death of the Buddha, Buddhism was basically a movement, groups of monks and nuns who wandered around, supported only by the benevolence of lay followers willing to give them food in the hope of getting good fortune or good karma and a better rebirth. Gradually, however, Buddhism became the first of the great religions to develop the institution of monasticism. According to Prothero, Buddhism went west in the 19th century via books, artifacts, and people, through translations of the Buddhist scriptures into European languages, through art collected by Buddhist sympathizers and deposited in places like the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, through converts, and through immigrants, particularly from China and Japan, to Europe and North America. Of all the Asian religions, Buddhism has had the largest influence on European and American popular culture. But the 20th century saw a decline in the number of Buddhists in South Asia due to the rise of communism in China and North Korea and of evangelical and Pentecostal Christianity in South Korea. Still, Buddhism is growing rapidly in Australia, New Zealand, and North America, thanks to ongoing immigration from Asian countries, spirituality which doesn't hinge on God, and Buddhism's compatibility with modern psychology. And of course, Buddhism has also benefited from the ongoing presence of the Dalai Lama, the Tibetan Buddhist leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner. Here, it may be important to say something about whether Buddhism is really a religion. Prothero suggests that, as with Confucianism, this question reveals more about our own assumptions about religion than it does about Buddhism itself. And this takes me back to a couple of presentations I did last year. I read a few sermon extracts from a famous Unitarian, A. Powell Davies. Davies defined religion as life of every kind viewed from the standpoint of meaning and purpose. And for Sophia Lyon Foss, and also did a presentation on her, a lead pioneer in children's religious education, this is the quote, "Life becomes religious whenever we make it so, when some new light is seen, when some deeper appreciation is felt, when some larger outlook is gained, when some nobler purpose is formed, when some task is well done. for me, for you, for others. Buddhism is a religion because we believe it to be one. And if you don't, it isn't. Whatever. Doesn't matter. And now I will conclude this presentation with a short section on meditation, which many consider to be the heart and soul of Buddhism. Like Hindus, Buddhists trace the human problem to the karma, or fortune-fueled, cycle of life, death, and rebirth known as samsara. And I'm putting those words in because you hear them very often, and it's nice to know what they mean. Buddhists believe that life is marked by suffering, so the problem Buddhism seeks to overcome is suffering, again, dukkha. The goal is nirvana, and I looked up nirvana. Nirvana literally means blowing out, like candles on a cake. So nirvana, you have blown out suffering, the candles of suffering. But in this case, nirvana means the goal is to extinguishing suffering. So nirvana, you blow it out. Buddhists use a variety of techniques to achieve this goal, but Buddhists are best known for the practice of meditation. Now, I'm going to ask you to try a little bit of this. I'm not asking you to meditate. I'm just showing you the strategy so you can think about it, okay? So let's take the time and try this. So probably the simplest style, and by the way, those of you who practice Buddhism, you sit in a certain way, don't you, to do the meditation? Or can you do whatever you like? Okay. You just have to be comfortable. Okay. All right. So, for those who are not familiar with this, then probably the simplest style of Buddhist meditation is just to follow your breath. You find a comfortable place to sit, and then just follow your breath coming in and going out. And when I learned it, it was mouth closed as the air comes in and mouth open as the air goes out. But those of you who do this, so just take a couple of seconds. Just again, I'm not asking you to meditate. I'm just asking you to try this, okay? Take a few seconds. Okay, I'll stop you. Now, those of you who are practice this kind of meditation, when I learned it, I was told that you weren't supposed to, I'm not using Buddhist language here, that I was taught to focus on something, so to look straight ahead. Well, actually not to focus, but to look straight ahead. So I was looking straight ahead, and I was seeing those pictures at the end, but I wasn't really seeing them because I wasn't focusing on them. Other people are told to close their eyes. You close your eyes?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, but the idea, you know, that as I said, I can do it because I learned to do it another way. I can do it. You know, those pictures, I say, oh, those pictures aren't there. Okay, and I just keep going. Okay. So that was the first, to be very aware of your breath. And I read somewhere else that it's kind of interesting that one of the things you think about is that comes to some people is think, you know, we don't really control breathing. Breathing happens, you know? So very interesting to getting in touch with your breath. So that is the basic one. Another popular practice is Vipassana. And by the way, I looked up all the pronunciation of these things, so I'm hoping I've got them. They pronounce them on Google. So Vipassana is translated as either insight or mindfulness meditation. Here, instead of your breath, you follow your feelings or thoughts or sensations. If you are bored, and I'm not going to ask you to do this one, because then, you know, if you are bored, observe that you are bored kind of thing. Okay, we won't do this one. If your back aches, observe that your back aches. So focus on that part of you. The aim of Vipassana meditation is to be mindful of things as they are, to watch how all conditions arise and pass away, and so to observe that no feeling or thought or sensation is final. Then metta. Metta is another form of Buddhist meditation, so these are the three main ones. The word is often translated as loving kindness, but it also means unconditional love, love without attachment or expectation of return. In this technique, you begin by feeling metta for yourself. Then you move on to cultivating unconditional love for a friend. And the key there is unconditional. Then you feel metta for someone you neither like or dislike. And finally, for someone you dislike. So you go in stages. In the next stage, that's the first. In the next stage, you feel unconditional love for yourself, your friend, the person to whom you are indifferent, and your enemy, treating them all as equally needful and deserving of loving kindness. Finally, you extend this feeling of metta to all beings everywhere in the world and beyond. May all creatures be of a blissful heart. And one of the things that's very interesting, and we in the hymn that we sang, I, you, we. Why? Because I have to be in touch with the goodness in myself before I can reach out to others. So it's not egocentric or anything. It's starting with unconditional love of myself. Because if I hate myself, how can I love other people? I don't know what it is, okay? Now, I'm going to end this presentation. Well, not quite end it, because I will say something about these books. And just a second, I wrote myself some additional notes. Just a second, I'm just going to check here. Oh, okay, before I get to the last part, I just have, Thier said, extra presentation stuff. And here was something I looked, I saw it when I reread the chapter in Prothero. It said, although Buddhism is widely associated in the West with meditation, most Buddhists do not meditate. They worship Buddha figures in temples, pray to them at home, and go on pilgrimage to sacred sites associated with their exploits. And again, I accept what Prothero says because that's his level, his field is religion. And another thing, that today roughly 445 million people identify themselves as Buddhists. So that's 7% of the world population. Okay? So Buddhism is number four after Christianity, which is one in terms of numbers, Islam two, and Hinduism three. Okay. So, back to metta then. Loving kindness. So I will end this presentation then with a version of one of the most well-known and often repeated mettas. And this is a version of it. We sang another version of it. And what I'm going to do is I'm just doing the, there are four verses, but it's repetition. But I'm just going to do the first one and the last one. So it's may I, may you, may we, may all. Okay? That's always the way that Buddhist meditations take place. Okay, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to say each of these. I'm not asking you to repeat them, but I'll pause just a second or two if you want to just put it in your head. Whatever. Whatever you want to do. Remember, this is not, I'm not leading a prayer service here. Okay. May I be peaceful. May I be happy. May I be well. May I be safe. May I be free from suffering. And then, as I said, if you say the whole thing, you then go to you and we. And the fourth is, may all beings be peaceful. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings be safe. May all beings be free from suffering. So that is the form of one of the most famous mettas. And just that is was really my conclusion. But then I did the what did I do here? I better pick this up. Oops, I was always in trouble there. I just wanted to say just very briefly what these books are. I have a collection, I've counted them, of 40 Buddhist books, and I think I'm going to start reading some of them again because I find them very interesting. Now, these are I won't say typical, but these are famous Buddhists, and you can take a look at them. Please don't take them away, though. Well, you can borrow them, but, you know, there'll be a slight charge for borrowing them. You have to bring them back, okay, to me. Okay, now this one, this is the one nobody can borrow this one because I'm working on it at the moment, okay? This is called The Myth of Freedom and the Way of Meditation. And it was written by, and here I don't know what the pronunciation, Chögyam Trungpa, founder of Naropi University, Boulder, Colorado, the first Buddhist university in North America, and the Shambhala training program. And Shambhala means place of peace. So when you there is a magazine, I have a subscription to Shambhala. So this is, he died a few years ago, but he was a Buddhist priest, I guess, I don't know, but originally from. This one. She is one of my favorites. I have read everything by her. This is Pema Chodron. She is a Buddhavista, so you say, what is it, a religious figure or so forth. She is one of the founders and resident teachers of Gampo Abbey, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, the first Tibetan monastery in North America established for Westerners. So this is right in our own country. And she was a student of this guy, what is he? Chögyam Trungpa. And she wrote the introduction to this book. I really love her work because I find it very, very positive. I can read what she says. Anybody else read some of her work? Oh, well, yeah, you have then. It's very, very positive. And it's not, it's something that if I want to, and again, I'm talking about me, not from egotism, but it starts with me. And we have to say this, all of us, it starts with me, according to Buddhism. But if I want to get more in touch with myself, I read Pema Chodron and I feel very positive. I feel there are things I can do. Okay, and then this one. This is Jack Kornfield. No, they're not in the order that I had. Okay, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. I love this title. How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path. Jack Kornfield was trained as a Buddhist monk in Thailand, Burma, and India. And he is, just a minute, I'm just moving here. He is the co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society. And Jack Kornfield, very readable. You know, you get into it. These are my favorites. Sharon Salzberg, A Heart as Wide as the World, Stories on the Path of Loving Kindness. And Sharon Salzberg is the co-founder of the Insight Meditation Sound Society in Barre, Massachusetts. And it's funny, when I got this, I had lent it to somebody because she was, and I won't mention her name, you know, not here in public, but many of you know her. And in 2004, Dear Helen, kindness makes the world a better place. Knowing you makes my life better. Thank you for all your kindness. That made me feel good. I lent her this to read. Another person that I have read nearly all of his, he was a very successful businessman and dropped everything to become a Buddhist. And this is Suryadas. And he is the most highly trained American lama, and lama is spirit, means spiritual teacher, in the Tibetan tradition. So awakening the Buddha within, 8 steps to enlightenment, so this is the Eightfold Path. And finally, this is this was a selection of my favorites. This one is, Wherever You Go, There You Are. Isn't that a lovely title? And this is mindfulness meditation in everyday life. Jon Kabat-Zinn, professor of medicine emeritus, founding director of the Stress Reduction Clinic and the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Health, Care, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. So these are books I used to reach for, and they were available, in chapters? I bought them in chapters. And there was some place on 13th Avenue that used to sell all these. I have quite a collection. Anyway, that's it for me.